KPFT.org, and thanks for your help before the fundraising campaign begins. This is KPFT Houston.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up, and each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, KPFT.org, Twitter.com/KPFT, Facebook.com/KPFT Houston.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today we will have two different segments on the show covering two different topics. First, we will speak with Father Nabil Hanna, pastor of St. George Orthodox Church in Indianapolis. We will speak with him about Syria, the status of Christians in Syria, the threats of U.S. attack and military intervention in Syria, and the prospects for a peaceful resolution to the war-torn country. In the second segment, we will speak with Alex Kane, assistant editor at MundoWise and at World Editor for Alternet. He is a blogger and a freelance journalist based in New York City. We will speak with him about the newly released top-secret document provided to The Guardian by whistleblower Edward Snowden, which reveals that the National Security Agency, NSA, routinely shares raw intelligence data with Israel without first sifting it to remove information about U.S. citizens. But first, let's start with Arab Voices Community Calendar. The city of Houston is organizing a human trafficking event titled Shine a Light on Human Trafficking. The main event will take place at City Hall, where the mayor, chief of police, Harris County sheriff, and district attorney will speak about the problem of human trafficking in Houston and around the world. There will be about 28 gatherings in the greater Houston area, one of which is at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center, where the event will be simulcast live to the gathering at the center. This event will be held on September 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the ACC, located on 10555 Stancliffe Road. For more information, send email to webmaster@acchouston.org. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center is sponsoring a mayoral candidates town hall forum on Wednesday, September 25th, beginning at 6 p.m., which will be held at the ACC on 10555 Stancliffe Road. Candidates for Mayor Ben Hall and Anise Parker will participate in the town hall meeting. Ben Hall will address the forum beginning at 6:30 p.m., and Anise Parker will address the forum at 8 p.m. The purpose of the mayoral candidates town hall forum is to give mayoral candidates an opportunity to address a wide range of issues that affect Houston and the Arab American community at large, as well as inform local citizens about the candidates running for the office of mayor. For more information, contact the ACC at 832-351-3366. The World Affairs Council of Houston will be hosting Dr. James Zobi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute, whom we've had on this show several times in the past. Dr. Zobi will be speaking on Polling in Egypt, Institutions, Leadership, and Society. Dr. Zobi will speak about the level of confidence Egyptians have in their institutions and current leaders, and what do Egyptians see as the path forward. This event will be held on Tuesday, October 1st at 6:30 p.m., at the Junior League on 1811 Briar Oaks Lane. For more information, visit wachouston.org. The original Greek festival will be held this year on October 3rd through the 6th at the Greek Orthodox Cathedral Complex near downtown Houston and the Museum District on 3511 Yukon Boulevard. For more information, visit greekfestival.org. And the annual Houston Turkish Fest will be held October 12th and 13th at Jones Plaza on 601 Louisiana Street. For more information on that, visit turkishfesthouston.com. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center will hold its annual Unity and Friendship Gala this year on October 5th at 6:30 p.m. at the Omni Hotel on 4 Riverway. It will be the ACC's 20th anniversary celebration gala, titled United We Shape Our Future. And this year, the ACC will be honoring Dr. Hazim Safi with the University of Texas Medical School as the 2013 ACC Outstanding Community Service Award recipient. Mr. Ahmed Al-Zayat, president of Aramco Services Company, will be honored as the 2013 ACC Lifetime Achievement Award recipient, and Schlumberger will be the recipient of the 2013 ACC Corporate Award. This year, the gala will be highlighting the Egyptian culture and people. For more information, send email to gala@acchouston.org. The Rothko Chapel will hold an event titled Peace Building Through Art and Dialogue, hosting members of Creativity for Peace organization that uses art to give young Israeli and Palestinian women a language to communicate their shared fears, pain, and begin healing and peace building. Israeli Maish Beta, Palestinian Joanna Ghalib, and Israeli Shirit Milikovsky are senior leaders with the Creativity for Peace. It's based in New Mexico, a nonprofit group with operations in both Israel and Palestine. They explore the transformations that they have undergone in the years they have been involved with the organization, their ongoing struggles with and passion for peace building, and their dreams for a future of peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians. Creativity for Peace Executive Director Dati Indik will be at the event. A reception on the plaza will follow the program. So this event will be held on October 8th at 7 p.m. at the Rothko Chapel on 3900 Yopon Street. For more information, visit rothkochapel.org. Egypt Cancer Network and Dr. Izzat Abu Auf, Egyptian actor and rock musician, are organizing the second annual gala of the Children's Cancer Hospital of Egypt, 57357. The gala's objective is to raise funds to sponsor a desperately needed 300-bed extension for the hospital. The guest speaker will be Liz Scott, founder of Alex's Lemonade Stand Pediatric Cancer Foundation. Mr. Zubair Al-Auti will entertain the guests as he plays his oud. This event will be held on October 20th at 5 p.m. at the Junior League of Houston on 1811 Briar Oaks Lane. And for more information about any of the events I just mentioned, or for a list of many other events scheduled in the greater Houston area, visit our website, and that's arabvoices.net. We will take a short break now, and when we come back, we will talk about two different topics. First, we will speak with Father Nabil Hanna, pastor of St. George Orthodox Church in Indianapolis. We will speak with him about Syria, Christians in Syria, the threat of a U.S. attack, and the prospects for a peaceful resolution. In the second segment, we will speak with Alex Kane, assistant director at Mundowise and at World Editor for Alternet. He is a blogger and a freelance journalist in New York. We will speak with him about the newly released top-secret document, which reveals that the National Security Agency routinely shares raw intelligence data with Israel without first sifting it to remove information about U.S. citizens. We'll be right back.
لما بتقتل تذكر عم تقتل خيك ولما تهدم تذكر عم تهدم بيتك لما تقتل تذكر عم تقتل خيك ولما بتهدم تذكر عم تهدم بيتك سوريا موجوعة عم تنزف دموع سوريا موجوعة عم تنزف دموع عولاد كانوا شموعة عأهل صاروا غرابة عأهل صاروا غرابة والسابة يا دموع السابة بالدم تعطر ترابة السابة يا دموع السابة بالدم تعطر ترابة للصار عأهل الفقر غرابة. مش رجولي تسفك دم تيد تنتفض تبكي ام الله ما بيرضى بالظلم لسه عحسوب حسابة. مش رجولي تسفك دم تيد تنتفض تبكي ام الله ما بيرضى بالظلم لسه عحسوب حسابة. سوريا موجوعة عم تنزق في دموعها. سوريا موجوعة عم تنزق في دموعها. عولاد الكان وشموعة عأهل الصار غرابة. عأهل الصار غرابة. والسكابة يا دموع السكابة بالدم تعطر غرابة. السكابة يا دموع السكابة بالدم تعطر غرابة. سكابة يا دموع سكابة عأهل الصار غرابة. عأهل الصار غرابة. بدنا تتحسن الظروف ونعمرها بالمعروف. ما في سوري بيرضى يشوف أرضه تودع شبابها. بدنا تتحسن الظروف ونعمرها بالمعروف.
Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener sponsored, commercial free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live via phone from Pennsylvania, from Indiana, is the very Reverend Father Nabil Hanna. He has been pastor of St. George Orthodox Church in Indianapolis since 1995. Prior to that, he served as pastor at St. George Cathedral in Toledo, Ohio, St. John of Damascus Church in Dedham, Massachusetts, and assistant pastor at St. Luke's Church in Garden Grove, California. Besides English, Father Nabil speaks Arabic and French and is proficient in ancient Greek and Hebrew. Father Nabil, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you, Saeed. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. We appreciate your time this evening. We'd like to talk with you about Syria and the status of Christians there in Syria and how Syria is important to Christianity, not just for Syrian Christians, but to many Christians throughout the world, as it is for Muslims and others. And talk about what's happening there, the violence and the threats of attacks on Syria from the U.S. and the involvement of so many other countries there. But if you could start by giving our listeners some information about Christians in Syria.
Okay, great. Of course, Christianity started in Jerusalem. The apostles of Jesus Christ went out from Jerusalem throughout the whole Middle East, eventually throughout the whole Mediterranean basin, and in their own lifetimes, spread from Jerusalem westward to Spain and eastward all the way to India. But Syria was a very important part of that. The Apostle Paul, when he was on his way to Damascus to persecute the Christian community there, saw a vision of the risen Lord and was converted himself. He went to Damascus. He went to Straight Street, where our patriarchal headquarters still remain. And there he was baptized by Ananias. Antioch was a place that St. Paul spent much of his time, as well as St. Peter. And it was the church in Damascus, that early Christian community in Damascus, that first received the name Christian. That was the first time the name Christian was used. And that church in Antioch, which is in present-day Turkey, just the way the modern borders have been drawn, but of course historically part of that area known as Syria. It was Antioch that launched St. Paul and St. Barnabas and others on their missionary journeys throughout the Mediterranean basin. So it is from the very beginning, these founding apostles, the chiefs of the apostles, Peter and Paul, who were there in Syria, in Damascus and Antioch and other parts, and it was there that they got launched on their missionary journeys, and there's been a continuous history of Christianity there. Very important, the School of Theology of Antioch, which has produced the likes of St. John Chrysostom, St. John of Damascus, and so many others. And the Christian community in Damascus, in Syria at this point in time, is about 10%. The population of the country is about 22 million. About 10% of that is Christians, the majority of whom are Orthodox, as we say, Rum Orthodox Christians. And then next in smaller portions, you have Roman Catholics, Syriac Orthodox, Lutherans, and other Protestant groups.
And they have that population of about 2.2 or so million Christians who live in Syria. They mainly, I believe, Aleppo is like the largest number of Christians, the city that has the largest number of Christians in it, and of course Maalula, and we will talk about that because it has been in the news a lot lately.
Well, and of course Damascus and many other areas as well.
Yeah. Now, for many, many years, Christians and Muslims have lived peacefully, and Jews also in Syria and so on. And we never, I don't recall a time, in my lifetime at least, that I've heard of any issues or problems between Christians or Muslims or even Jews and so on, whether it's in Egypt or it's in Syria. But only in the last few years, with the so-called Arab Springs and so on, we are hearing of attacks from this group against that group and so on, and they are drawn into this as if it's a sectarian or a religious war and so on. What's your take on that? I mean, have there been issues and problems in the past before what we are witnessing now in Syria?
If you're talking about past centuries, there's been problems, but if you're talking about through most of the 20th century,
yeah,
and up to the very present time,
mm-hmm,
no, it's been a wonderful, harmonious coexistence. And I truly lament that this is evaporating, and I hope we can recover it. This is our prayer. You know, we're not getting into politics. I, as a clergyman, my church, we don't want to get into politics, but we care for everybody. And, in fact, given the situation now and all the suffering, we are undertaking a lot of humanitarian work. We have the Patriarchate of Antioch working with international Orthodox Christian charities, is distributing food, medical care, shelter, blankets, you know, various necessities to all the suffering without regard to whatever their political persuasion, and certainly not their religion either. So we stand for a picture, a vision of Syria for its future, is to return to that harmony and perhaps even build upon it, where people can be personally deeply religious. You know, I, as a clergyman, surely want people to be religious, but without discrimination, without, let me restate this, so that it really counts. When people are religious freely, then it really makes their religion an integral part of their lives. It's not something forced. It's not something just expected. And then they all live together in peace, knowing God, who calls us to peace. This is our understanding as Christians, And we ask all those Muslims and others to search their hearts, search their own religions, and come back to that peace that we had and build upon it. This was the vision, I believe, of the young people who started the Arab Spring, whether in Syria or in Egypt. They had a vision of a future where you had personal liberty with responsibility, with mutual respect for everyone else. Unfortunately, as happened in Egypt, also happened in Syria, where some radical elements have hijacked the revolution, the aspirations of young people who are very enlightened and forward-thinking. And, you know, the people who were praying together, the people who were protecting the other group as they prayed, now find themselves excluded from the revolution. Again, because you're mentioning the term Arab Spring, whether in Egypt or in Syria, the vast majority of Syrians, as I am following this very closely, do not want what the opposition stands for today. They were with the opposition. Many Christians were with the opposition in terms of looking for greater democracy, greater personal liberties, openness. But once the opposition was taken over by extremist elements, both Christians and Muslims, by and large, have steered away from the opposition. In fact, the U.S. State Department, 2 months ago, conducted a poll within Syria. At that point in time, they found 74%, now mind you, the Christians are only 10% of the country, so this is not a Christian-Muslim thing, which is really my point here.
Mm-hmm.
The 74% of the respondents said if the choice were between the opposition and the Assad regime, they would choose the Assad regime, which of course is not much of a choice. It's a choice of between two evils. So, again, to reiterate, my point here is not to take political sides. That is not my intention at all. But simply to reiterate that while Christians have been suffering, perhaps slightly more targeted in this situation by some of the rebels, the vast majority of Muslims also are not comfortable with what the rebels have come to stand for, though they didn't start that way. These extremist elements taken over by Al-Qaeda, many foreign elements are now in Syria, because most Syrian Muslims, like their Christian counterparts, want to go back to that peaceful coexistence and harmony that had existed.
And you just mentioned that there have been and still is a lot of foreign countries involved, a lot of foreign hands already involved in Syria,
right,
from various countries, many, many countries.
Yeah.
They all have their hands on it, pouring arms left and right, and who knows. I mean, we are hearing now more and more of fightings amongst the quote-unquote opposition, amongst the rebels, big time within Syria.
Yeah.
The same thing as they are fighting the Assad regime, and the Assad regime is fighting them. The use of chemical weapons, who was using them, who wasn't, they are pointing fingers, and so on. So, and the Syrians are paying dearly for this. You've talked about the refugees. You're all helping in your church over there in Indianapolis, and many other organizations are helping too. But there are millions of Christians throughout the world, and many, many organizations, many churches have publicly said and are speaking loudly against the violence in Syria. They want a peaceful resolution to this, including a letter that was sent about a week ago or 2 weeks ago by Metropolitan Philip Saliba, the Archbishop of New York and Metropolitan of all of North America. He sent a letter to President Obama asking him, appealing to him, basically to stop sending any to stop any military action against the Syrian government, because it will basically lead to more deadly and costly actions, and nothing can be gained out of it. There are many Syrians that say that, well, the Assad regime has committed crimes, is killing people, some of them have family members killed. I know several of them here in Houston, and they think, well, what is it going to take to stop the Assad regime? There might be some factions within the opposition that are committing war crimes or committing this, but also the Assad regime is doing it. How are we going to stop the regime from doing that if it's not a military action against them? What's your take on that?
Well, I certainly am with my Archbishop. We don't need more fighting. You know, the situation in Syria right now is a typical one. As long as they have arms, they won't negotiate, because everybody wants to gain an advantage before they sit down to negotiate. What really needs to happen, and the United States, I believe, can play a very significant role here, is to help keep arms out, working with some of these other powers in the region, who are really fighting in Syria for control over the region, to be the regional superpower. If we can get everybody to stop pouring arms into the country, then there may be a chance for negotiations. Then there may be a chance for something to emerge. And I totally agree with you. I want to be clear on that. I'm not taking sides with either the regime or the opposition. Both have blood on their hands, and we hope something new will emerge. Maybe that will be the compromise, is that the regime does not remain, but maybe something along the likes, along the lines of the how this rebellion started, with the young people who want a future of Syria that is peaceful, that is respectful for everybody. Maybe that something like that will come out if both the extremes are excluded, whether it's the Assad regime, because I don't think they have much of a future. There are enough people who will not stop fighting, who will not accept that anymore, as well as, on the other side, the extremists, Al-Qaeda and extremist Muslim parts of the opposition. If both of those sides can be excluded and the Syrians themselves can get together without these other parties, maybe they can devise a future roadmap for their country where they can be rebuilding, because along this trajectory, there's not going to be much left to fight over in another year or so. The country's, you know, been wrecked so far. You know, I'm sure you and your listeners are following the statistics here. By the end of this year, it is projected that there will be 10 million who are out of their homes, out of a country of 22 million. That's nearly half the population. Their homes are destroyed.
It's truly astonishing. It's truly astonishing. Absolutely, we're really witnessing the destruction of Syria, the deaths, the destruction, the infrastructure, the homes, the refugees that are fleeing Syria outside, and those who are displaced within Syria. To have 10 million, half of the population, displaced is unimaginable. It's humongous. Father, let me ask you this question: with the efforts that you're all doing, so many churches, as you mentioned, here in the United States, are you all reaching to other groups also? And when you try to communicate this to the State Department, to the foreign policy advisors, to President Obama, like the letters that are sent to him by so many churches and other organizations, are these making any difference? Do you all hear feedback when you all ask for, we don't want military intervention. And what else can the U.S. do? I know you mentioned and you stressed on that they can help keep arms out. But what else can they do to really go back on the road of let's negotiate what's good, what's bad? How can they help? Obviously, nobody wants the U.S. to mandate who rules Syria or what happens in Syria. It's going to be the Syrian people. But to guide them and to work with many, many other countries, because all we talk about is whether we're going to attack Syria or we're not going to attack Syria. Who did the chemical weapons, who didn't? There is not much talk about what other ways that we can really do. There is a talk of Geneva 2, Geneva 2 for so many months, but there was Geneva 1. And what can people do?
Okay. Well, let me try to get the various parts of your question. First of all, have we received some feedback? Here in our area, I have written to our congressmen who represent us here in Indiana, and I have received personal replies. And they had all, the several who did reply indicated that they would not be voting for the U.S. attacking Syria. So I think that the campaigns of people, whether of Syrians, people of Middle Eastern background, or of the general population of the United States, has made a huge difference with Congress. At one point, I saw that the statistics were what was being communicated to Congress representatives and senators was 7-1 against a military action. That, to my memory, is unprecedented. So I think it is making a difference. I think that the United States can play a constructive role. First of all, what I already mentioned. Secondly, by sending in more humanitarian aid, the suffering is great. So the need is great. And then working with Russia, I think we have a unique opportunity here where the United States, which is has contacts with some of the elements of the rebels, and Russia, which has contacts and carries some influence with the regime, can work together as happened here to avert the military strike and to perhaps build upon that. Some of the other parties that are active are also allies of the United States. We have Saudi Arabia and Turkey, who have been playing active roles in the situation in Syria. Then the other party that is supporting the regime is Iran. I know the United States doesn't have direct relationships with Iran, although I saw even some news today that that situation, maybe behind the scenes, is starting to fall. There may be some communication. Again, I don't want to be getting into politics, but all I'm just saying is a prayer that maybe these elements can get together and we'll say, okay, how can we all help Syria rather than fighting each other in Syria? And then allowing the Syrian people themselves to develop their own aspirations, which, as you have said, have been to the memory of everybody living today. Because throughout the 20th century, Christians and Muslims and Jews have been living in Syria in a very good, harmonious situation where people live together as neighbors and have personal friendships.
Yes.
And if they can get back to that, I say, excluding these other elements, I think it's possible. And then for the United States, and as we did to rebuild Europe after World War II, if we offer assistance to rebuild Syria and become friendly to the Syrian people, support them, then we can perhaps have more influence. When they look to America and see that America is not the enemy, not the country that was, just to make itself feel good that we did something, is just throwing more weapons and more, and just lobbing some missiles into the mix to kill more people, just so we can say that somebody's got to pay a price because chemical weapons have been used. Whoever used them, we just got to do something for our credibility. Then the United States will be seen as a friend, and if they can look at our form of government, as imperfect as it is, but it's probably the best there exists on Earth, where we have a system that is democratic, but also protects all the rights of all the various minorities. Because a pure democracy, as Plato put it, would simply be mob rule. So we don't want that either. We don't want you have 51% and you get to do whatever you want and terrorize the minority. This is critical for people in the Middle East to understand as we are now trying to build democratic institutions there. It's not simply, well, you people vote, then the government that wins gets to do whatever they want. There has to be a rule of law and fundamental principles that protect everybody's rights, as we have in the United States here. And said, no matter what, if 99% of the people want to do something, it still can't be done if it's going to trample upon somebody's rights.
Yes, absolutely. And looks like the it's going to be a long way, but with the efforts and the ongoing continuation to work towards peace, to work towards peaceful resolutions, always to save Syria from the destruction, from this war, would definitely be obviously on the positive path, on the positive step. We're going to have to leave it at this. Father Nabil Hanna, pastor of St. George Orthodox Church in Indianapolis, Indiana, was with us live by phone from Indiana. Thank you so much, Father. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Evening.
It's great to be with you. We continue to pray for Syria.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And we are going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we will speak with Alex Kane, assistant editor at Mundowise. We will speak with him about a top secret document revealed last week that reveals that the National Security Agency routinely shares raw intelligence data with Israel without even sifting it to remove information about U.S. citizens. Stay tuned. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Joining us now live via phone is Alex Kane. He is an assistant editor at Mundo Wise and at World Editor for Alternate. He is a blogger and a freelance journalist based in New York City, writing mostly on Israel and Palestine, Islamophobia and the Middle East. And he writes for The Independent and a frequent contributor to the blog MundoWise. His work has also appeared in Electronic Intifada, Common Dreams, Palestine Chronicle, Red Pepper in the United Kingdom, Extra, Alternate, Salon, and the Gotham Gazette. Alex, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. We appreciate your time this evening. Last week, The Guardian, a British newspaper, released a top-secret document provided to it by whistleblower Edward Snowden, which reveals that the National Security Agency, the NSA, routinely shares raw intelligence data, I want to emphasize raw intelligence data, with the State of Israel without even sifting it from to remove information about Americans, about U.S. citizens. You have written about that. You followed it. Tell us more about it.
Right. So, yeah, you know, The Guardian, they published what's called a memorandum of understanding between the National Security Agency and the Israeli equivalent of that, which is called the Israeli SIGINT National Unit. And what it showed is that the NSA was handing over a lot of raw signals intelligence to the Israeli government, meaning that the NSA is giving Israel metadata and what seems like beyond metadata, even the content of phone calls over to Israel. This memorandum of understanding, it does stress the need for the constitutional rights of American citizens to be protected. Israel is not supposed to target U.S. persons, meaning U.S. citizens, permanent residents, or anyone on American soil during their surveillance activities, but there are also no legal enforcement mechanisms making sure that Israel does not target U.S. persons. So that's sort of the broad outlines of the news story that The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Ewan McCaskill published last week, and it's gotten some attention, although not enough.
Now, the disclosure or the documents that were revealed over the past few months about the NSA and the U.S. government spying, collecting data from phone companies and all that stuff, it was for, quote-unquote, the best interest of the United States, and they were safeguarding information, and they were not sharing it with others, and they weren't recording phone conversation or this or that. It's merely just monitoring and watching for certain calls that are made to foreign countries and so on. And with this information here, basically, I mean, that tells us that everything is on the table. How do we believe and how do we trust our administration here?
Well, you know, the administration has a lot to answer for, and so far they haven't been forthcoming. I mean, you know, I think one of the big problems, you know, this report raises more questions than it does answers. But one of the big problems, and we can say this for sure, is that this program is a secret, or was a secret, until Edward Snowden decided to take matters into his own hands. You know, why is this a secret? You know, shouldn't Americans have the right to know what their government is doing, both in terms of who they're sharing this information with and also what the government is, what kind of information the government is collecting on people in the U.S.? You know, that's a huge problem that we have. And, yeah, you know, the Obama administration has come out repeatedly and said that we're only using this for counter-terror measures, and that, as you said, you know, we're doing with the best interest of the American people in mind and so on. And then, you know, we have this news that the NSA is handing over lots of raw data to the Israeli government. You know, if there's and the Israeli government has shown itself to not be so bent on sort of respecting people's privacy either. So, you know, there's a lot of questions that come out of this.
And obviously the constitutional rights of Americans to privacy and the expectation of privacy, it's all meaningless in this case. Plus, in that memorandum of understanding, which I have a copy of it, and we'll put a link to it on our website, arabvoices.net, for our listeners. I have the actual top secret document, the 5 pages in it. It doesn't sound like it puts any limits whatsoever to what Israel can do with that data. And again, that data, by the way, it looks like it's all kinds of transcripts. It's not just voice and telephone calls. It's email, it's faxes, it's various communications that have been gathered and tracked, and it's just here, State of Israel, do whatever you want to do with it.
Right. Well, you know, the memorandum does state that Israel's not supposed to target U.S. citizens, U.S. persons for surveillance, but there are also no legal enforcement mechanisms to make sure of that. The NSA makes no attempt to take out U.S. persons' data before giving it to the Israelis, and Israel is allowed to retain it for up to a year. Now, the intelligence unit is allowed to disseminate foreign intelligence information about U.S. persons, as long as U.S. persons are not identified. There are some stated constraints. The Memorandum of Understanding does outline some stated constraints on this. So at least on paper, it's not willy-nilly, Israel, you can do whatever you want. But again, the fact is that we have no way to make sure that Israel is not targeting U.S. persons or identifying and spying on U.S. persons. There's just no legal enforcement mechanism to make sure that doesn't happen. And that's another one of the big problems that critics have raised in the wake of the report.
That's an important point. And by the way, they are estimating that this actually was signed, because the document itself doesn't look to have a date. This is going back to 2009, just few months, 2 or 3 months after Obama was sworn into office.
That's true. And, I think that just makes clear the extent of the continuity of policies when it comes to comparing the Bush administration and the Obama administration. You know, on every single NSA program, we basically had a continuation. I mean, the Bush administration made the mistake of doing things outside the purview of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That was the big scandal in 2005, where the New York Times broke a story about the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping of Americans. But we now have essentially the same program, but with warrants. Now, we have a court overseeing these orders given to phone companies, but there hasn't been any effective pushback. The phone companies are basically complying with government requests. And, as you said, you know, the Obama administration, when he came in 2009, he had an opportunity to review these NSA programs, including the one with Israel, and he continued it. And, one important point about that is, like, it may have been going on even before 2009. This is just when this memorandum is dated. But other documents that The Guardian referenced states that, you know, in the last decade, the relationship between the NSA and Israel tilted heavily in favor of Israeli security concerns because the survival of the State of Israel is a paramount goal of U.S. Middle East policy, and that's a direct quote from the document. So it's unclear if it just started in 2009. I mean, that's when the memorandum says it started, but perhaps it started right after 9/11 or some version of it. We just don't know, and again, it's like there's no transparency, so how are we supposed to know?
And for many, many years, we know in proven cases that the State of Israel actually spies on the United States government.
That's also the sort of irony of this memorandum. You know, Israel and the United States spy on each other. As part of the Snowden documents that were also reported on by The Guardian, we find out that Israel routinely spies on the U.S. government to figure out our policy positions on Middle East questions. This is not a surprise, I don't think. Allies spy on each other, countries spy on each other, but it is ironic that at the same time that we're giving the Israeli government all this information, they're spying on us, and then, you know, we're also spying on them. It's a two-way relationship here, but it's certainly ironic.
Yeah. Do we know of any, we don't know of any cases or anything that may have happened because of this? Obviously, things remain top secret and so on, and they don't have to reveal how they got that information. But we don't know if anything has happened to any U.S. citizens, at least, based on this information sharing, right? Or at least not yet.
That's right. That's not yet. I mean, you know, it's possible that The Guardian will do further reporting. Obviously, I'm not sure of that. So there, again, you know, there are a lot more questions than answers that come from this report, but still significant in its own right.
Yeah.
And it reveals the very sort of close relationship between U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies. And, you know, I mean, the immediate question that comes to mind is, you know, we already know that Israel has given trouble to American citizens it doesn't like American citizens of Palestinian or Arab background. They're known to have trouble trying to enter Israel to visit family or to just visit the country. They're detained and harassed and sometimes deported. You know, prominent cases in recent years include a Palestinian-American teacher named Noor Judah and others that have tried to enter the country for work or activism or family, only to be deported and harassed.
Yeah.
Although, again, I do want to emphasize that has, as far as we know, nothing to do with the National Security Agency giving data on them. But again, I mean, it's unclear.
Yeah, and over the past week, since this has was revealed, at least I have not seen any in the mainstream media or really the corporate media any talk about this, because if the U.S. shared information about U.S. citizens to any other country in the world other than Israel, I'm sure all those corporate medias, they'll be making it headline news and it will be breaking news every day and so on. But because it's Israel, as if it's okay, and nobody even talks about it. Unfortunately, go ahead.
There was an interesting New York Times article by their public editor who questioned why the New York Times hadn't covered this story, and one of the managing editors told her he didn't think it was significant. The public editor, Margaret Sullivan, disagreed, but that, you know, the New York Times said, well,
yeah,
not much of a story. So, yeah, you're right.
Because it's Israel. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll catch up with you again, maybe, Alex, to talk about this and many other things that you write for our listeners. We'll put a link to his blog on our website, arabvoices.net, and a link to the Mondawis, where he writes and he publishes his articles. Alex Kane, assistant editor at Mondawis, has been our guest. Thank you so much, Alex. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks,
and that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening, and many thanks to Sherry for her assistance. Technology Bites is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer on Host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
The KPFT Community Advisory Board is requesting your participation in a listener survey. The KPFT Community Advisory Board, also known as the CAB, is a vehicle for effective community input to the station's governing body about station programming, community service, impact on the community, and the station's major policy decisions. Congress believed the establishment of community advisory boards would assist stations in developing programs and policies that address the specific needs of the communities that they endeavor to serve. The Community Advisory Board is required to produce a listener needs assessment. Please visit the KPFT website at kpft.org and complete the Community Needs Survey. If you are a member of KPFT, you will receive an email with a hyperlink for completing the short form. Thank you for your help, and thanks for listening to KPFT Houston.
League City announces the return of its own family-friendly music festival. The second annual Boogie Blues and Brews will take place September 20th, 21st, and 22nd, and will bring together the best of blues, country, Zydeco, and more from all over the region to Walter Hall Park. This year's lineup includes Cody Canada and The Departed, Eric Gill's band, Hamilton Loomis, Brian Jack and the Zydeco Gamblers, Cowboy Mouth, and more. The event will feature a variety of arts and crafts, vendors, a sweet tea competition, and a chili cook-off, all in true Texan style. Second annual Boogie, Blues, and Brews in Walter Hall Park in League City, September 20th through the 27th.